Dara, many thanks for joining us here on Highland Radio. You are an academic based at the University of Bath. You grew up in Donegal. You're widely regarded as a leading authority on the changing relationship between gambling and sport. And you've just published a book called Imitation Games, How Gambling Hijacked Sport. Very topical that I'm talking to you just after the World Cup final. No doubt there was millions spent around the world on all sorts of bets. So first of all, maybe just tell me a little bit about the book and the reason why you decided to write it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Firstly, Chris, it's been a pleasure doing lots of Irish media over the last month, and it means even more to me to do some local media in Donegal. So it's a pleasure to do this. The book does a couple of things. I guess the first thing is it traces the growth and expansion of online gambling. So something very different to, you know, what even I would have grown up with in Donegal in the 90s and early 2000s, you know, where you'd have kind of cycled down to a local village and walked into an actual bookie and handed over, you know, physical currency and placed a bet maybe on the outcome of a game or a horse race. I really trace the revolution that was the internet, then the smartphone, the rise of social media, and kind of everything that the big tech giants of the Silicon Valley unleashed on us. And so the book makes this argument that we're in a new age of online gambling that's faceless, it's frictionless, it's accessible 24/7. And I guess at the heart of the book is this idea that sport has been central to the growth and the expansion of this industry. And it's all in that term hijacking, of course, this idea that sport's been key to the reduction in the age of the punters that the gambling industry pursue today, the shift to focus away from horse racing, and really the reframing of gambling as a mainstream entertainment form rather than a known addictive industry.
It really has never been easier to place a bet. And given all the time and research that you put into the book, have you found out that it's an even scarier world that we live in than you actually had thought at the start?
Absolutely. There's a chapter of the book called Gambling's Dark Web, and that's really about data science and surveillance capitalism. And I think there's a sense among most parents now that, you know, online safety is something we need to consider. And I guess one of my key arguments in the book is that all parents should consider gambling as part of that online safety today. And you know, the idea of, you know, whether our kids should have smartphones. Well, the day they have a smartphone is the day they have access, you know, if they're over the age of 18, is the day they've frictionless access to a vast industry. And it's not just sports gambling today. Of course, it's the online casino as well. And the World Cup is a great example of that. A lot of young people will download an app to place a bet on, you know, one of the games. And the truth is, when they do that, they're nothing more than a click away from the online casino, which is one of the most ruinous, addictive products, you know, there is.
Now, I know I was actually listening to the radio during the week, and I know there's going to be a tightening up in relation to various aspects of gambling here in this country. How soon and how effective that is remains to be seen. But just to give people an idea, a few figures. For the UK, for example, 1.4 million problem gamblers, you're saying. So proportionately speaking, in Ireland, you're running into tens of thousands, maybe even over 100,000. It is a serious problem.
It is a serious problem. And the intro to the book makes clear that we don't take serious how serious this problem is. You know, there's a bit of a societal, a kind of historical lag. You know, it's only 2014 onwards that gambling is considered a real addiction. And so there's a degree of lag in how we, you know, Irish society understand gambling. You know, for generations, it was probably written off as something you could kind of, you know, pull yourself together and get over. But the truth is, you know, you speak to any family and there will be a ruinous story of addiction, of gambling addiction somewhere in that story. And the truth is, you know, those figures you've just quoted me, Chris, are figures on problem gambling. And the truth is they're very unreliable. They're poorly measured, often using different kind of measurement tools. And they also don't look at the scale of harm overall. So that is the idea that, you know, be below the level of kind of clinical addiction, there are many kind of hundreds of thousands in Ireland or millions in the UK more that are being harmed by gambling in ways that remain largely hidden and unseen, because the truth is gambling is largely an invisible addiction, and its harms often remain kind of concealed until, you know, people's life are at the point of implosion, really.
Now, tell me a little bit about a number of the companies that the book really focuses on, and just, I suppose, how prominent they are, and to many of us, they are household names.
Yeah, the book, you know, for across 400 pages, it's fair to say the book attempts to tell different types of stories. And of course, you know, the truth is, in a different light, the stories of some of these companies are genuinely extraordinary. You've got, you know, to start at home, you've got Paddy Power, which is central to the kind of narrative of the book. You know, this company that emerges from the kind of the fusion of a series of Irish bookmakers who are concerned about the spread of British firms like Coral and William Hill in Dublin. They band together to kind of, you know, push back the Brits, as it was, and in the process realize that they've got a unique market and stick. They really kind of realize that their humor and marketing can be used to kind of expand. And of course, what happens is they come back across the water and become one of the biggest gambling firms, not just in the UK, but today, of course, globally, you know. And that's an extraordinary story of marketing, Paddy Power. Then you've got Bet365, whose founder, Denise Coates, goes on to become the highest paid woman in the UK, you know, a woman that's paid more than kind of all the kind of Fortune 500 companies put together. And she's a woman very much emerging into this man's world. And she pioneers what today we know as this in-play betting, which of course carves up a single sporting event into kind of hundreds, if not thousands, of micro markets. And that's an extraordinary story. And you've got Sky Bet, which of course is this kind of in-house betting firm founded by Sky Sports, which is the broadcaster most associated with the incredible rise of the Premier League. And they kind of see a customer base that is in-house already, and they see the potential of a gambling firm as early as the kind of turn of the century. And they're just three of the firms. Then there's Betfair and a whole host of other firms that whose stories are told in the book. And one of the most remarkable parts of that story is that they all emerge within, some of them within a couple of months of each other. And there was this mad scramble online. You know, they're all kind of trying to launch websites and get their apps off the ground. And it becomes this Darwinian arms race to kind of, you know, become market leaders. And the book kind of traces where that takes them, you know.
And of course, many people familiar with, you know, the advertising, it's very much in your face. You can hardly watch a sporting event without some sort of betting company being to the fore, and all sorts of things like free bets and bonuses. And if you do so much betting, you get so much extra free. People think, you know, it's a bit of fun, it's a bit of crack, but not for everybody.
No, and, you know, that's the most pioneering part of what this industry did. The deregulation of gambling in the UK and Ireland meant that at a certain point, 2007 in the UK, for instance, suddenly gambling firms could come out from behind frosted glass. They were free to market, and they partnered with some of the best marketing firms in the world, and they created slogans, taglines, and ultimately this narrative that gambling wasn't an addictive kind of product, but rather kind of could be, you know, a harmless entertainment form. And that's where sport really comes in, because sport, particularly betting on football, was this kind of fresh new take for the industry. And they threw, you know, at first tens of millions at it in terms of marketing. And today, you know, there's up to £2 billion spent in the UK each year on marketing gambling alone. You know, the average Premier League, the opening Premier League week last season, 30,000 exposures to gambling across the Premier League matches. And that's kind of volumes only the most crude measure of what they're doing there. They also became ingenious kind of content marketers. And part of that is the inducements you just mentioned. You know, I do many talks where I have to break down the kind of deceptive nature of inducements, like you just mentioned, this idea of, you know, bet £5 or bet €5, get €50 in free bets. And the average young person, the average young fan doesn't understand all the ways in which they're being deceived when they kind of sign up to an app based on a deal like that. This idea that, of course, they're handing over €5 of fungible currency But what they're getting back is basically a digital currency that will have to be wagered a certain number of times before it's withdrawable from the gambling platform. And of course, all of this is engineered in favor of the gambling firms at every turn. And if there ever was a time where, you know, that old age-old notion that you might be able to beat the bookie if you had kind of, you know, if you really knew your stuff, this idea that sports betting was monetization of knowledge that fans actually had, I think one of the things that the book does well is hopefully it demonstrates to fans today that it truly is a mug's game, as one of the chapters sets out. The gambling firms kind of are, you know, 20 steps ahead of you today rather than perhaps 5 or 10, you know, 30 years ago.
One of the features of the books is that you include a number of case studies, and indeed you've also been in contact with some footballers who themselves have been drawn into the whole darker side of things and who have suffered considerably.
Yeah, one of the most enjoyable, if harrowing, chapters in the book for me was I was very lucky and worked very hard to negotiate access to Sporting Chance, which listeners might know as the charity that was founded by Tony Adams, the former Arsenal and England captain. And it's an incredible charity. It's a kind of one of the only addiction clinics in the world for elite athletes. And I was able to spend, you know, confidential time there looking at kind of what they do and really the scale of how they begin as a charity that's treating predominantly alcohol addiction. That kind of is the noughties takes over, becomes more about drug addiction and kind of other addictions, but gambling isn't on the radar at all. And then kind of the second decade of the noughties, there's this kind of floodgates opening where gambling becomes the main presentation for addiction and elite athletes. And really what they helped me see is kind of these canaries in the coal mine of an industry where it's spilled onto the field of play. You know, you've kind of record numbers of athletes now being either banned or berated for their own gambling, their own use of products. They're in essence endorsing every weekend on repeat for most of the year. And there's also kind of this something that I tried very hard to unpack, this tension, but it's changing the relationship between fan and athlete as well, in the sense that you have fans turning on their heroes when bets go wrong. And so in a certain sense, you've suddenly got athletes at the heart of this storm. And I guess in a whole different light, you've also got ex-athletes, our own Roy Keane being one of them, endorsing the gambling industry at every turn. So it's a world full of tension and hypocrisy at the moment, Chris.
Now, it's a big, big industry, particularly when you look at the football clubs. Going forward, Dara, things may tighten up in terms of gambling and laws and restrictions, but given the volume of money in it, there's going to be considerable resistance. How do you think it's all going to pan out? You know, if you look at the changes over the last 5 years, can you make any prediction as to where we'll be in another 5 years from now?
Well, whether I can make the prediction in five or perhaps a decade, I do hold a great deal of hope, and I would actually implore people to remember that there is precedent here. It's only two decades ago that tobacco sponsorship was still in sport, that somehow it was morally appropriate for that to happen. And there came a day where, you know, we all knew that this industry was no longer appropriate to be on what are community clubs. We shouldn't be exposing kind of young people, fans, communities to this. And of course, the same happened with alcohol. We are currently seeing a reckoning with social media platforms. You know, they're being kind of, there are lawsuits on a monthly basis ruling them as harmful and defective. We are increasingly aware of online safety issues. So when I look at all of that, Chris, I actually think that the reckoning with gambling is kind of overdue and imminent. So I would kind of implore people to remember that this all of this didn't happen through evolution. This was an industry manufactured from the turn of the century, and governments should be held accountable for that and should be held accountable going forward. This can, you know, we can roll back here. Sport also can take accountability. We have ex-athletes, we have football clubs, we have governing bodies that could take a stand and privilege public health over kind of profit and greed. And so I think fans and communities have a big role to play in that. And politically, I see this changing quite quickly. I guess, regrettably, what tends to happen with these harmful industries is the quantum of harm grows and grows and grows before real change happens. And so I'm loath to allow that to happen without calling it out. And so whether it's 5 or 10 years, Chris, I do hold hope for change.
And just before I let you go, no harm in just recalling your own past. You grew up near the Manor roundabout and you played soccer with a number of local clubs before going to fields further away, including a sports scholarship in Canada. So just give us the background.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asked a lot about kind of the idealism that's kind of at the heart of the book that I've just written. And of course, that's derived from my own very positive experience of what sport is in Donegal and what it can be for young people. You know, I go on to do a PhD in my 20s, and the idea of, you know, kind of a relatively working class boy from rural Donegal doing a doctorate probably wasn't in the stars for me. And it's football that takes me there. You know, it's, you know, I went off to Loughborough to do a master's and played football there, and the opportunity to do a scholarship over in Canada alongside a doctorate and spend 5, you know, brilliant years in Canada. And all that begins with, you know, local football clubs in Donegal, like Drumahol and Letterkenny Rovers and later Finharps and Derry City. And so, when I'm asked about the idealism, I constantly think of home, you know, because it's shaped what I think of sport and hopefully has shaped kind of the moral and ethical aspects of what the book tries to argue for.
And just one further point there, since the book was published, I suspect you've attracted quite a lot of publicity because of the topic itself.
Yeah, and one of the nicest things has been, you know, I've been away from home now, you know, well over a decade. And although I'm home 2 or 3 times a year, this has brought me home in a different way in the sense of, you know, I've engaged with nearly every corner of the Irish media. So that's been, you know, really fantastic. And of course, there was, you know, launches in the UK and Canada and Ireland. And so I've had a crazy 6 weeks. But given that the book was nearly 5 years in the making, 5 weeks of media felt apt after that, you know.
So, Imitation Games, How Gambling Hijacked Sport by Darragh McGee. It's published by Bodley Head, available in all good bookshops, as they say. And can you get it online as well, Darragh?
You can, of course, and an audiobook